You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
Last month, the Council of Canadians organized a six-city tour to say no to pipelines and no to tankers. The tour started in Fort McMurray and ended in Prince George. The third stop was Burnaby, BC, where residents are organizing to oppose a planned expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline running through their community. Bill McKibben was one of the speakers on this leg of the tour. Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature in 1989. It's a book that has been called the first book on global warming written for a general audience. Bill McKibben is the founder of the environmental organization 350.org. The name refers to the 350 parts per million many scientists say is the safe limit for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Here is Bill McKibben, recorded at Alpha Secondary School in Burnaby on October 25th.
I'm an odd man out here because I'm not from here, okay? And it's a reasonable question why you should pay any attention at all to an American come up across the border to talk to you. In fact, you may recall sometime 6 or 8 months ago when Mr. Harper said that, in fact, all the trouble was really being caused by foreign extremists and radicals that were arriving. And I sort of thought, I think maybe he was sort of talking about me in some measure, because we, but I have a funny story to tell just as I begin about that. Because when I was a boy, I lived my grade 1 through grade 5, I lived in Toronto. My father was the bureau chief for that radical magazine, Business Week, and for Canada. And so we moved up here from the States for five. And then, of course, those were important years, you know, your elementary school years. And I went to Northleigh Public School, which was a very good place for me. And I hadn't really thought about it for a while until a reporter for one of the papers, after Mr. Harper said that about foreign extremists and radicals, looked it up and discovered that 1 year ahead of me, with the same teachers and the same classrooms and everything else in the Northleigh Public School, was one Stephen Harper. So wherever all that radicalism, I mean, it was like a controlled experiment, you know, in what would come out. Now, I don't have any right to talk to you at all about what you decide to do here in Canada, though I think it's wonderful to see the power of the kind of witness that's beginning to emerge. I first learned really about the tar sands from a wonderful young woman, Melina Lubicon Cree, and who spoke with more passion and eloquence than I could ever have imagined about what was going on, and then to sort of learn about the pipelines running hither and yon and the damage done when they spill. Those things are things that I have no doubt that you all will come to grips with, and I know that you are, and I am so glad to see this resistance forming here. And we've watched it with such admiration from down south, watched the, watched just this week the great gathering on Monday with thousands upon thousands of people. And that was wonderful to see. The part where I feel, though, where I might get to speak a little bit is just to remind everybody that there is yet a greater danger that comes from all of this. And you all are very lucky here in Burnaby to get perhaps to play a really outsized role in the greatest fight that human beings have ever had to take on, this fight against the biggest thing that we have ever done on this planet, change the composition of its atmosphere and hence heat its climate. I wrote the first book about global warming for a general audience 23 years ago now, a book called The End of Nature, and it you know, 23 years ago, we knew that it was going to be bad, but we didn't know how fast it was going to be bad, and we didn't know on quite what scale it was going to be bad, and we could not have predicted. We couldn't have predicted the kind of things we've seen just this year. I mean, in my country, we're coming through what's going to be the hottest year in American history, unless something very odd happens in the last 2 months. We're going to break every record. And that heat, July was the hottest month ever measured in the United States. That heat and the dryness that came with it was enough to wreck the harvest on the richest farmland in the world across the Midwest this year. And as a result, the price of corn and soybeans on the world market's up 40%. Now, most of us can deal with that, but there are a couple of billion people on this planet for whom that's the biggest thing that happened this year, the fact that they had to get up every morning and find enough coins to go to the market and buy cornmeal to make tortillas, and now it's 40% more. That's an awfully big deal. Look north of you. I mean, Caleb just showed those great maps of North America, but what they don't show on the upper edge is what happened, the one thing that people 100 years from now, looking back, will remember about 2012, was that it was the year when the Arctic, the sea ice in the Arctic, all but disappeared. We had unbelievable, out-of-control melt when the long Arctic night finally started descending in late September this year. There was only about, by area, half the ice, and by volume, 25% of the ice that was there 40 years ago. We have taken one of the three or four largest physical features on the planet, and we have broken it. Okay, and that should grab our attention in the most visceral way. Okay. The other big features of the world are following right behind. You're very right to worry about what will happen if oil spills in to the beautiful Pacific. But you know, even before the oil spills in, the chemistry of seawater is changing, and changing radically as it absorbs carbon from the atmosphere. The ocean is 30% more acid than it was 40 years ago. Okay, it's already making it incredibly difficult for creatures at the bottom of the marine food chain to form their shells and things. So it's, the ocean is our metaphor for vastness, for bigness, you know, and yet we've managed already to begin to alter it in profound and damaging ways. And we are only at the beginning of this kind of change. We've raised the temperature of the Earth 1 degree so far, but the scientists who told us that that was going to happen tell us that unless we get off coal and gas and oil far faster than any government's currently planning, certainly far faster than the Harper government's planning, that 1 degree will be 4 or 5 degrees before this century is out. And there is no way. I mean, civilizations cannot work if we let that happen. The agronomists at the University of Washington and Stanford published a study last year saying from this point on, every degree increase in global average temperature should cut grain yields 10%. So if you raise the temperature 2 or 3 degrees, you're talking about cutting back the number of calories on this earth 20 or 30%. And watching Iowa and Illinois this summer, you saw exactly how that could happen. Try to imagine what it means for anything that you care about on this planet, whether it's development or war and peace or hunger or women's rights or all the other things that we've worked hard for. Imagine what happens on a world with a third less calories on it to go around. It's the biggest thing that ever happened, and we've got to stop it from happening. And we got to stop it from happening fast. And that's why that movement, that resistance that Maud was talking about is so incredibly important. And really the only news I want to give you tonight is that it's beginning to form, that you have brothers and sisters all over the world now who are starting to engage in this fight. We started 350.org. Which draws its odd name from what the scientists say is the most carbon we could safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, okay? A number, sadly, that we're already past. The atmosphere outside here and every place else in the world is about 395 parts per million now and going up 2 parts per million per year. That's why the Arctic melted, okay? But we started this going on almost 5 years ago now. And we started it with myself and 7 college undergraduates. That's all we had. And we had no money and no organization. And this was the first time that anybody had tried to start an organization any place on the planet that was just devoted to taking on the biggest problem we ever had. Well, you know, each of those 7, since there were 7 young people, and since there are 7 continents, each one of them took one. Okay, and we set out to organize the world. It was ludicrous and pathetic. The guy who took the Antarctic also had to take the internet, okay? Ludicrous and pathetic, and yet not through any because of our great abilities. It kind of is working because there are so many people around the world now who can see what's going on. All of us feel too small to do anything about global warming, and that's why we have to figure out how to come together to do something about it. The reason we took on the tar sands and the Keystone Pipeline in the U.S. last year was because our greatest climatologist, Jim Hansen, said, if you could burn everything in Alberta tonight, happily you can't, but if you could figure out a way to all the economically recoverable oil, you would raise the atmospheric concentration of CO2 from 395 parts per million to 540 parts per million. Okay, this is the second biggest pool of carbon on Earth up there. And it is crazy, crazy to just go ahead and burn it all up. It makes no sense. It doesn't, you know, there's not a scientist in the world you could find to say it's a good idea, but it hasn't stopped at all industry or government from going ahead and doing it. You would think that when the most important climatologist in the world says, do this and it's game over for the climate, that might give somebody some pause, but it didn't. And so we, not knowing what else to do, more than a year ago now, asked people to come to Washington and get arrested, to sit down in front of the White House. And before that 2 weeks was over, 1,253 people had been arrested. It was the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years in America. And then two weeks later, with Maud in the lead, lots and lots of people arrested on Parliament Hill in Ottawa, and one of the biggest actions there in a long time. And this is spreading like wildfire all over the world. In the EU, with the leadership of the Indigenous Environmental Network and others, big challenges to tar sands oil pouring in there. And we're doing the same thing in, you know, other, in Australia, we're fighting giant coal mines. And in Kosovo, this, you know, last month, we've been working on this huge new coal plant. 350.org has organized about 20,000 demonstrations in the last 5 years in every country on Earth except North Korea. CNN said it was the most widespread political activity in the planet's history, okay? And that's only because there are so many people now who are feeling the effects of all of this. We did a global day of action this past spring that we called Connect the Dots, and all we did was ask people wherever they were to rally who had felt the sting of climate change already. And there were thousands of these places around the world. The pictures just began pouring in from every direction. Underwater demonstrations on the coral reefs and the Marshall Islands, because those coral reefs are just melting away in this hot acid ocean. And 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 people high up in Himalayan and Andean communities whose glaciers are disappearing, and people in Siberia where wildfires are, people in Pakistan where 20 million people have been dislocated in this crazy flooding that results because warm air holds more water vapor than cold. You just, you know, load the dice for both drought and flood, on and on and on all over the world. And it was beautiful to see, but it was also hard to watch, too, in a sense, because so many of those people are in places where they can't really do anything about it. It's not their fault. They're not burning carbon. The most they can do is bear witness to their suffering and hope that we notice. There was a really poignant picture that came in from Haiti, just lots and lots and lots of young people standing in this kind of dirty, swollen stream, and they just had a sign that said, in English, your actions affect me. And it doesn't work the other way around, you know. Nothing they can do to do anything to us, to all they can do is... And so you guys are, in this sense, I mean, it's your misfortune that you're in a community where they want to put a huge pipeline that brings vast amounts of carbon every hour of every day for decades to come, you know. That's your misfortune because it's no fun to live near that, and I know that you'll... But it's your good fortune to be able to play a really outsized role in stopping this, to be able to be real, in a sense, heroes in this fight, okay? And it's not, I know, an easy fight. This is the richest industry on earth. I mean, no hyperbole. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money, you know? I'm no theologian. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, but it's my conviction that these guys have more money than God, you know? And which means that we do not stop them with money. We're not going to outspend them, okay? We need other currencies, and those are the currencies of movements. Passion and spirit and creativity, and sometimes we got to be willing to spend our bodies too, you know, once in a while. I'm in a good mood today because, you can't tell, but I am, because one of my great friends, a young man named Tim DeChristopher, who was arrested 2 years ago for a really brave act of absolutely peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience to try and stop gas leasing of the kind that Caleb was describing, but down in Utah in the United States, he got sent away for 2 years to jail, and he got out to the halfway house today. He's out of prison, which makes me happy. And I am thinking of our brothers and sisters down in Texas trying to block the southern leg of the Keystone Pipeline. And I can tell you, we'll try in the States and many other places to do our part as best we can. As soon as the election's over, the night the election's over, we go off across this 20 cities and 20 nights tour of the United States to try and rouse all kinds of action against the fossil fuel industry in general, because we're not going to win just, we have to fight each pipeline, but we also have to sort of go after the industry as a whole to point out that they're now a kind of rogue industry pouring carbon into the atmosphere that we cannot deal with. But we're definitely not giving up. I mean, everybody keeps saying, oh, Obama will approve the Keystone Pipeline the moment the election's over and things. Maybe so, but we're not going to give up in any way. November 18th, a week after the election, we're doing a big rally in Washington about it, and a much bigger one come January. We're going to try and make him at least face the fact that his legacy will in large extent depend on what he does to try and keep coal and oil and gas in the ground where it's safe, where God put it, you know. So that fight will continue, and I know it will continue up here, and we're so grateful for you, all of you, to carry it on. Let me end with just two stories, two things about that that civil disobedience and arrests and things that we did in Washington a year ago, just in case any of this happens to come up here, you know, okay? There were two things that were interesting to me about this. And first one is, and I'm kind of looking around at the demographic makeup of this room, you know, when we sent out this letter, and Maude signed it when we sent it out, asking people to come to Washington and get arrested, one of the things I wanted to make sure didn't happen, okay, was that college students and young people would have to be the kind of cannon fodder, okay? Because in our economy right now, if you're 19 or something, maybe an arrest record is not really the best possible thing on your resume, okay? One of the few unmixed blessings of growing older is past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you? You know. So it was great fun to watch, you know, lots of people appearing in Washington with hairlines kind of like mine, you know. And we did not ask people how old are you, because that would be rude. But cleverly, we said, who was president when you were born? Okay? And the two biggest cohorts came from the FDR and the Truman administrations. Okay? So the last day there was a man arrested with a sign around his neck that said, World War II vet, handle with care. He'd been born in the Warren Harding administration, which is so long ago that even those of us who studied American history in school have a hard time remembering there was a Warren Harding administration. Okay? So that was lesson one. It's going to take all of us, all right? Young people have led most of this fight around the world, I can assure you, but it's really good to see elders of all kinds stepping up and doing their part, okay? Second thing we said was, when you come, if you're going to come, get arrested. Maybe be all right, maybe be nice if you would wear a necktie or a dress when you do it. Okay. I live in Vermont in the woods. Neckties are for funerals pretty much in my estimation. But this case, we thought it was important to send a really powerful visual message. And the message is this. There is nothing, nothing radical about what any of us are asking for. All we want is a world more or less like the one that we were born into, you know? More or less like the one that human beings have known for all the 10,000 years that we call the Holocene, this period we're now leaving fast behind as we raise the temperature places where it's never been in human history. All we want is a world a little bit like the one we were born into. That's really almost a conservative request, no? Radicals work at oil companies. If you are willing to get up every day and make your fortune, and those fortunes are vast, by altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere, then you are engaged in an act more radical than any human being before you has engaged in. And it is time to try and put a stop to that radicalism. And that's why it's very good to see all of you here tonight with a real chance to do it, you know, in your place. And we will be watching with such hope and admiration and affection, not just from the United States, from all over the world. Okay, I have traveled spewing carbon behind me to every corner of the world in the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, pretty much nonstop. And I can tell you that absolutely every place now, there are meetings like this going on tonight in 1,000, 100,000 gymnasiums of schools and church basements and mosques and wherever else as people come together to try and form this resistance that Maude talked about. I don't know if we're going to win, but I do know that we're going to try. I do know that we're going to fight. It's always such an honor to be in those rooms, and it is such an honor to be in this room with you all tonight and just say I look forward to being shoulder to shoulder with you as it goes on. Thank you all so much.
We've been listening to Bill McKibben, recorded in Burnaby on October 25th. Following the talk, there were a number of questions. Co-op Radio's own Alex Smith asked one. Here is Alex Smith's question, followed by Bill McKibben's answer.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and I want to direct this question to Bill McKibben. A lot of my listeners are in the United States. They're in San Francisco, they're in Florida, they're in New England. Why should they care at all? Why should they be listening to this? Why should they care about what's happening up in northern Canada somewhere?
You know, they don't call it global warming for nothing. This is the first issue we've ever had that really does require the entire world to try and come to terms with something. I mean, you know, we can have a long, actually not so much anymore, but there was sort of a debate about, say, whether secondhand smoke was as dangerous as smoking cigarettes yourself or whatever. But there's absolutely no debate about whether secondhand carbon is as dangerous. I mean, you burn tar sands oil in China or you burn it in Alberta, burn it anyplace else, it has exactly the same effect on the climate. And there are now people in every corner of the world feeling the effects. Where I live in Vermont is as bucolic and beautiful as parts of British Columbia. But last year we had the biggest rainstorm that we've ever had, and it just about tore the place apart. We've lost 500 miles of state highway and 15 bridges, and there were 9 towns cut off from the rest of the town next to mine. They were airdropping food in via helicopter. And you know, I'm happy to be here tonight, but I confess I've got one eye on the weather report, because there's another monster hurricane now coming up the east coast of the United States, and the ocean temperature off New England is 5 degrees warmer than normal. It's the highest ocean temperatures ever, which means that that hurricane will be able to suck up incredible amounts of moisture. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold, and it'll dump it, someplace, if not on Vermont, then on New Hampshire or on New Jersey or on New Brunswick or someplace along that route. It's a nice idea that we should just take care of our own places, you know, and we should take care of our own places, and we should make them as good as we can and build as solid communities as we can, and we're going to have to, because we have to adapt to that which we can't prevent, you know. We've been busy building much longer bridges in Vermont so they won't wash away next time, and so on and so forth. But remember what I told you about, we've raised temperature 1 degree and we're going to do it 5 degrees unless we stop. You have to adapt to that which you can't prevent, but even more, you've got to prevent that to which no one can adapt. And that's just the place where we are right now. The tar sands, at least the latest data I saw from Jim Hansen, I said, if you could burn all the economically recoverable oil up there, that would be more carbon than humans have yet burned in all the other things that they've burned, okay? There's a lot of stuff. Now, exactly the same thing is true of huge coal mines in Australia, you know, and huge fracking fields in the eastern United States and tar sands in Venezuela. It's not the only place in the world we can do this, but we no longer have any margin. We just melted the Arctic, okay? So we've got to stop all these places from going on. I'm rambling on here. Let me just say, it is a bad sign when you eliminate one of the major physical features on the Earth, and it might be the sort of definition of a wake-up call, you know, to watch the Arctic melt. The next few years are just a really interesting test as to whether the big brain was a smart adaptation or not, you know, whether it's connected to a big enough heart to kind of get us out of the trouble that we've gotten into, and that's what we'll find out.
And that was Bill McKibben, recorded during the question and answer period following a panel of speakers on the recent No Pipelines, No Tankers tour organized by the Council of Canadians. We're going to play you one more response from the Q&A. Here's Bill McKibben responding to a woman who asked what she could do about global warming.
I'm going to answer this one just very quickly. It's exactly the right question. There are lots of things one can do in one's home. By now, we know what a lot of them are, and all of us, I assume, are doing some of them. And you cannot make this problem go away. You can't make the math work one household at a time. It requires systemic and structural reform. Among other things, it requires putting a price on carbon that would reflect the damage that it does in the atmosphere. And the only way to do that is by affecting our political systems, okay? And that means that, I mean, often when I, you know, some TV reporter or something will say, what are the three things that people could do to, you know, and they want you to talk about light bulbs and you know, hybrid cars, whatever. And I always say, well, the first thing one could do is organize with people in one's community. And then the second thing you really should do is get together with your neighbors to organize. And then really the third thing would be to round up all the people you know and kind of organize them together to do something. And if you have some energy left over at the end of that, by all means, put in the light bulb, you know. That's all right, too. But, man, you guys have so much leverage right here. Take your effort to stop this darn expansion of this pipeline. And if you do that, you will have done more per capita than just about anybody on the face of the earth, you know, and it will be a thing to tell your children and your grandchildren about. A really, really valiant and noble victory if you can pull it off.
We've been listening to Bill McKibben, recorded on the Burnaby stop of the Six City No Pipelines, No Tankers tour. Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature in 1989. He is the founder of the environmental organization 350.org.